He's good.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is the United States against Brown. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Palaszczuk, on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant Philip Brown. The phrase, with intent to unlawfully attain an advantage, to wit, sexual relations, fails to state an offense of extortion. In 1984, the President narrowed the definition of those kinds of type of conduct that can be susceptible to an extortion conviction. That narrowing requires that the object of the extortion, in this case, sexual relations, be more than simply against the victim's will. The charges in this case illustrate the problem with this case, in that the appellant was convicted of both rape and also of extortion for the same act, which was against the victim R.A.'s will. In that charge, the government alleged that the appellant did, with the intent to gain an advantage, to wit, sexual relations, to communicate to R.A. a threat. Nothing in that specification indicates that the appellant received an advantage. Nothing in there says that the appellant received superiority of position to indicate that there was
an advantage. What's an advantage for these purposes? Obviously, he wanted to have relations with her. Isn't that enough?
No, Your Honor, it's not. Because
why not?
In this case, once again, there was nothing in this that the government proved that was any more than against R.A.'s will. And the precedent.
The wording of the statute is quite broad. You can say, you seem to be arguing in a circular fashion. What about obtaining sexual relations, which he desired, obviously, isn't advantageous to him?
Well, Your Honor, the advantage, it's not really a superiority of position. It's more of a, if they would have charged this with a value, we would have a more difficult case because it would be
Are you arguing that sexual relations have an intrinsic value?
It has an intrinsic value, yes, Your Honor. According to Hicks, this court said it had an intrinsic value.
But you're arguing it's not an advantage?
It's not an advantage, Your Honor.
Okay, so
what does it mean to say he took advantage of her? That's a common phrase, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's a common
phrase.
That's
usually a reference to someone having, you know, sex with somebody, right? Take advantage of the situation, or he took advantage of her?
That is a common phrase,
so we just get that phrase out of thin air?
No, Your Honor, but in this case it's clear that if the government wanted to prove that there was the offense of extortion here, they use loose language, advantage.
Oh, wait a minute. So you're saying the government mischarged this thing?
That's correct.
You're saying they should have charged it as value,
they
and then it would have been okay?
Yes, Your Honor, it would have been more susceptible to being okay, because the President, according to apparently relying on McCollum, narrowed the advantage aspect of the definition for taking
advantage.
Yeah,
but McCollum turned on their not asserting that it was an advantage at all, just saying it was sex.
That's correct.
Here you've got a spec that says it's an advantage, to wit, sex. What more is needed?
Well, Your Honor, it has to be more than just against that person's will.
I'm leave that out of it. I'm not focusing on whether she wanted or didn't want to have sex with him. I'm focusing on whether sex was an advantage to him. That's what the spec asserts.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the President, following McCollum, said you should put that in the specification.
And they did.
It's an advantage. They did. And it has to be more than against that person's will.
Well, that's, you know, you're not answering my question. My question is not, was it against her will? I'm assuming it was against her will. My question is, why isn't having sex an advantage to him? You haven't answered that yet.
Well, Your Honor, an advantage is considered a superiority of position. And
leaving aside who was on top.
Can I try the question a different way?
Sure, Your Honor.
You said it has to be something more than against someone's will, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why isn't the sex the more?
Your Honor, because it's clear that the act itself, the threat, there has to be a threat, and that threat has to be asking that person to do something that's just more than against their will, according to the President's narrowing of the
definition. Right, it's more than against their will. It's an advantage to him.
It was not an advantage here because he didn't gain a superiority of position, Your Honor. He may have gained something of value, but he didn't gain a superiority of position. So that is a distinction. If they had charged us a value, we would have a much more difficult case. But with their charging it as an advantage, that's you know, it's not, according to Hicks, this is something of value, but it isn't necessarily an advantage. And if you look at Hicks, one of the things this court did in Hicks, it discussed both advantage and value, used them interchangeably. The president, pursuant to the change, says, no, they can't be used interchangeably. One has to be more than an advantage has to be more than just against that person's will.
Do you agree that whatever the change was that is made and that you rely on to the A4 manual was based on McCollum?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And
so can you point out McCollum, what language specifically supports your argument that sexual relations is not an advantage?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you look to the dissent in McCollum, also Judge Everett's dissent, he discusses making sure that these specifications are clearly pled.
Right, that's a specification issue.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He's concerned that the person's not on notice as to what the advantage is.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But that's different than saying, having put the person clearly on notice, I mean, who's to say that wouldn't satisfy Judge Everett, the two-wit sexual relations?
Well, there's two aspects of the specification. One is to put on notice, and the other is to provide for double jeopardy protection.
Okay, but show me exactly the language you're relying on in McCollum that supports the proposition that sexual relations is not equal an advantage. And you can do it on rebuttal as well if you'd like.
Your Honor,
but
it's
your case is based on McCollum. I just want to make sure I'm tracking the exact language you're relying on.
Well, Your Honor, I do not have a page number here, but it's right at the beginning of Judge Everett's dissent. The definition of extortion in some statutes includes a threat with intent to compel a person, so threatened to do any act against his will. So that is making clear, at least in my reading of it, that he's saying that some statutes do that, and that's all it has to do is be against that person's will. But Judge Everett is saying that under the military law of extortion, there need be more.
Yeah, he's saying that you need to assert more. That it's an advantage.
That's correct.
Which the government did here.
But then the president, using that language, and that is the only language in McCollum, which the president cites as his reason for doing so. The
president cited nothing.
Well, excuse me, the Code Committee, Your Honor, cited as precedent for why they were making the changes.
The language in the manual says an intent to make a person do an act against that person's will is not by itself sufficient to constitute extortion. So a person who threatens another person with violence in order to obtain sexual relations cannot be convicted of extortion under that rule. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Is that what we have in this case?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. We have him threatening. It wasn't really violence. It was a videotape that he said he was going to release to the command, which showed him and RA and another female having sex. That was one of the threats that the government relied on. And the other was just the rape itself, the fact that he forced her to have sex in the car.
But the rule doesn't say an intent to make a person do an act against that person's will is not sufficient to constitute extortion. It says it's not sufficient by itself.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there must be something more than the intent, the threat, and the act against the person's will.
Yes, there must be something more.
And there's nothing, in your view, there's nothing more in this case than
that. There's nothing more in this case than the underlying act, which is what they also charged him with, was the rape in the automobile.
Are you claiming it's multiplicious?
That, Your Honor, that is not an issue that's before the court, but in this case it is multiplicious, clearly, because it is the same conduct being punished twice.
But there's elements to extortion that don't appear in rape.
Well, in this case, the element that was both in the rape and the extortion was he threatened her
No, but there are elements to extortion that don't appear in, you know, the statutory definition. One is not statutory definition. The other, and that's not an LIO.
That's correct, Your Honor. If for extortion, you need to have the threat, first of all, the threat. And
Also,
in this case, unlawfully obtain an advantage, and then there's rape is different.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in your view, a person who obtains sexual relations with another person by communicating a threat that does not amount to force can't be convicted of rape, it can't be convicted of extortion either.
Your Honor, could you rephrase? I didn't understand.
Is it your view that a person who communicates a threat to another person, threat does not amount to use of force, can't be convicted of rape and can't be convicted of extortion either?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can't be convicted of anything.
Your Honor, I think, and the appellant would concede that in this case he at least did communicate a threat. And if you look at Judge Everett's dissent in McCollum, he too said that's what he would find McCollum guilty of is communicating a threat. And in this case, it's clear that Sergeant Brown, the appellant, did communicate a threat to R.A.
And what about obtaining sexual relations not amounting to rape is not an advantage?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a superiority of position.
What about is not an advantage?
What about it is not an advantage?
Right. What about obtaining sexual relations with another person is not an advantage to the person who communicated the threat?
There's nothing prospective he's receiving. He is not receiving anything of you know, anything other than the sexual relations. It's not a superiority position. He is not in a better position after he engages in that sexual relations than he was before.
He might think he is.
Well, he definitely wasn't in this case, Your Honor. There are no further questions. We ask that this specification be dismissed.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your presentation. You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Jonathan Rebell, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Stillingham, represent the United States in this matter. The extortion specification at issue in this case states an offense. It states an offense because it informs the appellant of the charges against him, it enables him to prepare his defense, and it protects him from double jeopardy. The President's 1984 change to the manual for courts martials did not fundamentally alter the nature of the crime of extortion under Article 127, nor did it supersede this court's holdings in McCollum and Hicks. Accordingly, the court should affirm the Army Court's decision below. Turning first to appellant's argument here on which act constituted the extortion and which act constituted the rape. The two acts are not charged as the same act, and the appellant wasn't convicted on the basis that those two things were the same act. And it's important to remember that under Article 127, extortion is complete upon the communication of the threat with the requisite intent. The rape, the sort of consummation of the extortion that appellant had already undertaken is a separate act, and it is charged separately and sentenced separately. This court has long held most.
Well, if the offense is complete upon the communication of threat, which means before the sex occurred, then what did he get that was of advantage?
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't need to receive the advantage, the thing of value, the acquittance, or the immunity to be convicted under Article 127. If he makes the threat with the intent to gain those things, one of those things as charged, he has committed extortion under Article 127.
Okay.
Some statutes are different on the state level, but this is what Article 127 says.
So the offense is completed when he makes the threat in the expectation of getting the sex.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There are two sentences in the discussion section which seems to be in play, or the explanation section which seems to be in play here. And the first sentence seems to address Judge Everett's issue with specificity. The second sentence does what?
The second sentence, Your Honor, makes it clear that the thing alleged that was sought by the extorter or the accused needs to have value. It cannot only be something against the victim's will.
So by itself means without something of value?
Something of value, an advantage, an acquittance, or an immunity.
How would you have written a sentence to communicate what the government's position is in this case? Or shall I say better communicate? So we might not be here.
Well, Your Honor...
Or do you think this says this is as well written a sentence, making it as clear and declaratory as possible what the law is in this area? You can take that position as well if you'd like.
Your Honor, I think the government's position is that this sentence is sufficiently clear, given the specification that's before the court today.
No, I understand. I'm not trying to trick you into conceding otherwise. I'm trying to understand what the sentence adds that the first sentence doesn't imply already. And secondly, if you were to write it even clearer, how might you do so?
To make it slightly clearer, Your Honor, one would want to say specifically that value, advantage, acquittance, or immunity must be alleged, as the first sentence states, and that a valueless act that is only against the victim's will is not within the ambit.
But why would you need that there if you already have value in the element? I don't understand why you have to say that if you're going to assert an advantage, it has to be an advantage with a value, and that makes advantage and value redundant.
Your Honor, it's not redundant because value is a more commonly used term, and it is easier to understand. Value is often, in extortion cases, monetary value. So it's less necessary to state specifically what the value is if the accused is charged with extorting $1,000 from his victim. The second sentence makes it clear to trial counsel that when the advantage or immunity is perhaps non-quantifiable, it needs to be explicitly stated in the charging document what the value or advantage or immunity was to the person who was seeking it.
Counsel, I'm not sure the paragraph in the manual states what you said it states. As I read the first sentence, it says you don't have to set forth the advantage or immunity in the specification as an absolute matter. That when it is clear from the circumstances, it's not required to be set forth in the specification. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the second sentence doesn't say anything about value, does it?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't.
Okay. So in the second, could you give me an example, give the court an example of the second sentence, the circumstance in which a person would make a threat and that act would not constitute extortion?
Your Honor, the value and advantage, as this court said in Hicks, are broad terms and are determined through the eyes of the person seeking whatever it is that's sought. So an example of something that has no value could be on facts that are so extreme that it's simply whimsy on the part of the person seeking whatever act or thing is being sought.
Well, how about an example? I mean, the president put those words in the manual. What was he trying to convey at that point to to those who would be trying cases in courts martial asked when he said, an intent to do a to make a person do an act against that person's will not by itself is not by itself sufficient to constitute extortion. So what did the president have in mind, or can you give us an example from real life, hypothetical would be fine, as to an act in which there would be a threat that would not constitute extortion?
Well, one court that dealt with this issue is a Michigan state court, and it found in that case the accused was charged with forcing his victim to write a statement out saying that she was spreading lies about him. And the court there found that was mere whimsy on the part of the accused extorter, that it was not serious enough to fall within the ambit of Michigan's extortion statute. That is an example from another court's case law that was found to be so non-serious that it had no value as a matter of law.
How do you answer the defense's contention that this should have been charged as value and not advantage? Or does it matter?
It, Your Honor, the government's position is that it could have been charged as value.
What's the intrinsic value of a tryst?
Well, as this court said in Hicks, sexual favors, as you termed it in that case, or fulfillment of subjective desires, have value and can constitute an advantage,
albeit non-quantifiable, except maybe in the black market.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And numerous non-quantifiable things, statements against interest, as was the case in McCollum, have been found to be advantages or things of value. This specification, in this case, states an offense because under U.S. v. Crafter, it first alleges every element of the crime of extortion. It gives the accused notice of the charges against him and allows him to prepare his defense and protects him from double jeopardy. First on the elements, the specification follows the MCM's model spec, which in and of itself does not make it legally sufficient, but it alleges a threat and it alleges the requisite intent to gain an advantage, and in this case it describes the advantage as sexual relations. Notice, the appellant defended himself at trial as to the factual sufficiency of the charges against him. He expressed no confusion whatsoever as to what he was being charged with. And in Crafter, this court went back and looked at the trial record and assessed how the appellant handled himself at trial to determine whether or not he was on notice of the charges against him. And finally, double jeopardy, setting aside the multiplicious argument, which I addressed earlier, the record shows that if the appellant were to be charged with the same conduct at some point in the future, he could plead his former conviction and avoid double jeopardy.
Counsel, so turning back to the second sentence, the intent to make a person do an act against the will is not sufficient. So by itself, the rule doesn't say that you disregard the intent to make a person do the act against that person's will. So what is the plus in this case that takes it beyond merely an intent to get the person to do an act against their will? What's the plus in here that makes it sufficient under the second sentence?
The plus in this case, Your Honor, is the appellant's intent to have access, if you will, to sexual relations from his victim on a prospective basis going forward in the future. The nature of their relationship prior to his making of this threat is not part of the analysis. First, the victim had withdrawn her consent and was seeking to get out of the relationship. So the plus is the benefit to appellant, the superiority of position that he gains from being able to have sex with her as he chooses going forward. And again, under under Hicks, sexual acts, sexual favors can constitute things of value or an advantage under Article 127. The President's 1984 change to the MCM didn't fundamentally alter Article 127.
Leaving aside what it did, does the President have the authority by executive order to narrow the ambit of a criminal statute enacted by Congress?
He does, Your Honor. Article 36 allows him to...
allows him to make procedural rules. Didn't we say in Ellis v. Jacob that he has no authority over substantive criminal law? Isn't this substantive criminal law?
It is, Your Honor, but in the Sestian case recently, this court has also said that if concerning Part 4 of the MCM, if the President sets forth a rule that accrues to the benefit of the accused and is not directly contradictory with the ECM, the court will follow.
But that's a prudential rule. That's not saying he has, that's saying if we think it's nice, we'll follow it. That's not saying he has the authority to vary substantive criminal law, is it?
That's correct, Your Honor. The President can set forth rules on how things must be proven and procedures for doing so. So he's not...
Congress has given him
the terms of the statute as set forth by Congress.
And isn't that what he's doing here when he says that if it's purely against a will and nothing more, it doesn't constitute the statute, it doesn't constitute an offense within the statute?
It's not what he's doing here, Your Honor, because the statute specifically states that the accused need to have the intent to gain a thing of value, an advantage, an acquittance, or immunity. So that's part of it.
Well, and the President's saying that this isn't a king of value, an advantage, or an immunity.
That's correct. The President is saying what the statute is not saying.
Exactly.
That's correct. Whether he has that authority, I think under the court's prudential rules, this accrues to the benefit of the accused, and so the government's not challenging whether or not he has the authority or whether.
I know you're not. I know you're not. I'm asking you the question. Thank you.
Following up on that, counsel, all the cases that we had following Solis regarding Article 107, don't they stand for the proposition that when the President is simply attempting to articulate what's in case law as opposed to providing the accused with a right, then we are not bound by what's in the manual?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that off the top of
okay.
my head. We'd be happy to get back to the court.
No need for that.
The 1984 change, the government submits, did not affect the central holdings of McCollum and Hicks. The central holdings of those two cases are twofold. First, McCollum, that value and advantage are extremely broad concepts, and second, in Hicks, that sexual relations or sexual favors, as the Hicks court put it, is clearly something of value.
Counsel, can you articulate for me again, and I'm sorry if I've missed it in your response to other people's questions, but what, in your view, did the 1984 change to the manual change?
The 1984 change, Your Honor, set forth for the government exactly what must be charged under Article 127. That's shown by the changes to the model spec at the same time and to how discharge before the court is laid out. Post-1984, unless the value, advantage, acquittance, or immunity is clear from the circumstances, it needs to be explicitly discussed in the charging document. So you can compare that to the specifications in McCollum and Hicks, which did not track the statute as closely as the specification in this case does.
But what do any of the things that you just said have to do with the language and intent to make a person do an act against that person's will is not by itself sufficient? What did that change seek to accomplish? What was different after that change to the explanation?
What was different after that is that the plus factor needs to be explicitly alleged and proven at trial. And so the plus factor is the subjective value or advantage to the accused extorter of the act sought. So there must be some charge and some element in the proof that the act or omission had some value to the person seeking it. A charge and a trial that simply alleged nothing more, an intent to make a person do something against his or her will, would not be legally sufficient after 1984. Unless the court has further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude. The specification at issue here states an offense because it meets all the requirements of United States v. Cracker for a valid specification. Again, the 1984 changes to the MCM didn't fundamentally alter the nature of Article 127, and they didn't nullify this court's holdings in McCollum and Hicks. The Army Court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, at the outset, I'd like you to address Solis, which is at 46 MJ31, which the court viewed similar questions with respect to Article 107. And the court said that there are three ways to look at the language in Part 4 in that case, that the president may have simply given an expansive description of dicta, the president might have provided protection for the individual, or it might have been guidance for the conduct of investigations. This court never held in Solis or any of the cases in 107 that the language in there, that was the exculpatory no doctrine, actually provided such protection. Now here, all we have in the analysis is a reference to McCollum. How do we know that the language in the manual regarding Article 127 is anything more than an expansive discussion of the dicta in McCollum?
Your Honor, it appears it's more of a protection for the accused, telling the government that we deal with extortion every day in our lives, dealing with people, dealing with children, dealing with relationships. You have, do this or else type of communications all the time. So the president's saying that for an advantage, it has to be more than just against that person's will. And that's providing a protection for the accused in this case. To say to prove this, you have to do more than just allege that he gained an advantage. You have to show what that advantage is to prove this.
So how could the specification in this particular case have been worded differently to state an offense under your view of the language in the manual?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant's view is if they would have alleged value. If you look at what the manual defines an immunity and an advantage, and it talks about has to be more against that person's will for those two aspects. But it doesn't talk about value, and in this case, and if you look at Hicks says, sexual favors in that case was a value. And so the president, however, said for an advantage, possibly recognizing how often we deal with communications which are, do this or else, or those kind of communications, since there has to be an advantage, and that advantage has to be proven, defined, more than was done in this case. This case would be a value case, we probably wouldn't be here if they had a charge he gained something of value, sexual relations. The appellant agrees that would be a much different case, but that's not what we have here. The president said, as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, as a matter of approaching cases, look to an advantage and make it clear that the advantage is more than just against that person's will, because there's a lot of conduct that would fall under extortion if that was not the case. In this case, there was no advantage gained by the appellant in this case. wasn't a tactical advantage, wasn't a legal advantage, as was the case in McCollum. And there were no value, which, if you look at Hicks, they discussed sexual relations, sexual favors, as either value or an advantage. But first of all, Hicks was a case that fell under the old manual, so the court didn't discuss this provision of the president's definitional narrowing. And furthermore, Hicks really, if you look at that case, is one paragraph where it defines it, that sexual favors is something of value. And that's not what we have in this case. We have a much different situation in this case. We ask that this court dismiss the specification. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:45 a.m.
All rise.